The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
Royal attraction and distraction for beleaguered Britons and a worldwide audience. The wedding of Prince William and Commoner Kate.
Afterbirth politics. Does Obama's long-delayed disclosure of a long-form birth certificate trump the Trump and other GOP doubters, plus musical chairs at Defense and CIA?
Uprising update. Stalemate in Libya and over Syria, and how Egypt, absent Mubarak, is rewriting relations with Iran, Israel, and the Palestinians.
Fidel's further fade. But does his loss of another leadership position mean real reform for Cuba?
To see or not to see, new films about a killer tire and a presidential assassination and more.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of GateWave Incorporated, the nonprofit volunteer 24/7 radio reading service that brings vital information and enrichment to those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of May 1st, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
Oh, William Arthur Philip Louis.
Take thee, Catherine Elizabeth.
Take thee, Catherine Elizabeth.
Aye, Catherine Elizabeth.
Take thee, William Arthur Philip Louis.
Take thee, William Arthur Philip Louis.
Britannia ruled the waves again last week thanks to the royal wedding of Prince William and Commoner Kate Middleton. At least the airwaves and webwaves, at least for as many as 3 billion viewers not otherwise occupied fighting terrorists in Afghanistan and Iraq, or not fighting for and against democracy in Syria, Libya, other Mideast hotspots, or not struggling to survive disasters, both natural and man-made, from quake, tsunami, and nuclear-crippled Japan to tornado-devastated areas of the United States to economic hard times in Britain itself.
For those who cared, the tsunami of video carried all the best details. That no longer secret Sarah Burton wedding dress, the royal pair's sly smiles, and Will's brief struggle to slip the ring on Kate's finger in Westminster Abbey. The open carriage ride back to Buckingham Palace, and not one but two kisses on the balcony there. Then the young marrieds driving off in Dad's old sports car, a just-wed plate on the back with a number 5 for the S, as if they couldn't arrange the real thing, and a nice L for learners on the front, despite the fact that they've been a couple for years.
But for the 1.5 million actually assembled in the streets of London, the magic was less about seeing than being there. So reported Boston Globe staff writer Billy Baker, and for your ears only, he joins us now for some special sidelights of the royal wedding. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
You found more wedding mania among Americans there than among the Brits. What kind of explanations did the visitors give?
We were here for a week, and at the beginning of the week, we spent a lot of time talking to the Brits about the buildup, and they seemed to point to us, flip it on us and say, it's you Yanks that are really into this, but I think by wedding day, the million plus people that were there, there were no nationalities. Everyone was pretty keyed up and excited, and it was quite an event.
Another factor seemed to be a certain public familiarity with Will and Kate from the years they lived almost normal lives among their future subjects.
Yeah, a friend of mine, an American who lives in London, would put it this way, we see them at, our favorite restaurants, we see them about town. It is that sort of familiarity, and the saying is familiarity breeds contempt. In some cases, that seemed to be what we were hearing from people. Others were unabashed in their excitement, and then there was sort of the middle ground, the lukewarm. We'll take the bank holiday, we'll watch it in the pub. It'll be fun to celebrate because everyone loves a wedding. Endorsements were I won't say few and far between, but as the week went on, it seemed like it was hard not to get swept up in both this fairy tale and the British ability to deliver pomp and circumstance like none other.
For much of the time before and during the ceremony, you were surprised by the civility outside, the benevolent bobbies, your ability to move around. And at one point, though, you found yourself being used as a tripod. Tell us about that.
It was, the British people have been wonderful this week. The police, this was a logistical nightmare. There were just so many people, and rather than get a little cold and distant, it was, you'd ask for directions, and they would welcome you as a friend, and come wedding week, there would be instances where I'd be standing somewhere, and I couldn't believe that I'm in the middle of the street at Westminster Abbey, and they're not chasing me off the road right away. There was even a very cute moment in the morning of the wedding. The crowds are there. We're waiting for Kate Middleton to make her way from the hotel to Westminster Abbey. And someone just let their dogs run free around the rotary, the statue in front of Buckingham Palace. And rather than panic, the police just sat there and watched these two dogs play and entertain the crowd. And it was really sort of a sweet, laid-back, calm moment for this police force and this country. It really went well.
Talk about the sleeping bag races in St. James Park.
Yeah, well, you have to understand, I don't know how many people actually camped out, but it was, you know, in the tens of thousands. And by the time, you know, the sun rose behind Big Ben, some were loopy, some were drunk. there was a sort of a general, you know, I don't know how many actually got sleep, but you had a lot of young people who were, doing things like, you know, having potato sack races in their sleeping bags. You saw all sorts of men and women in wedding dresses, but strangely, mostly men, William and Kate masks and outfits and the camping setups. I thought I would feel bad for the people camping out because it was supposed to rain. It ultimately didn't, but the setups were really just fantastic. I mean, you know, they had the ability to make a pot of tea. They were drinking champagne. They were sharing with each other. It was really sort of a gregarious shared experience.
You did a lot of tweeting about the wedding day and what you called your embracing the ridiculousness. What would you say were your best 140 characters on the episode?
My thumbs are a bit sore. It was sort of the perfect venue to use Twitter as a form of journalism. With the time change and things like that, the morning newspaper, it was certainly already old news by the time things came out, but the ability to just sort of transmit immediately was wonderful. And, you know, it was just more like see it, write it down, send it out to our readers. And it really got a wonderful response. I haven't been a Twitter convert until now. I've been saying I'm going to retire, but you know what? It was there was one that seemed to be quite popular, which was in midweek where I just saw a guy wearing a Prince William face mask. And I took his photo in front of Buckingham Palace, and then I wrote that he smelled of lager. It was symbolic for me of the entire week. That was a sort of scene you saw, happiness, celebration, a bit of tongue-in-cheek mocking of this whole royal idea, but ultimately hard not to be won over.
And you got some good responses from your followers, like the fireman back in Boston with a warning for Wills?
Yeah, he suggested he get in his helicopter and chop her out of this whole thing because it's a bad idea. But there were just moments there where we spent a lot of time down on the mall at Buckingham Palace, Westminster Abbey, on the parade route, interacting with people. And you would just forget that inside one of these large stone buildings were a young man and a young woman about to get married. I know, in the build-up to my own wedding, you know, you're just dealing with so much chaos, and you have these small moments where you realize what you're actually about to do. And I would wonder if you know, William were in there, thinking about it, having second thoughts, who knows?
What among the sea of wedding souvenirs did you find most tempting, the Wills and Kate barf bag?
I didn't actually see those. I know those were quite popular, a lot of people writing about them. We did see Will and Kate condoms. They said there was a cartoon of the two, and it said, and they live happily ever after, something like that. You had your sort of what I would describe as sort of your traditional kitschy English souvenirs, the plates, the bells, the spoons, that sort of thing. But, there were lots of places you could buy things, but there weren't lots of things to buy. I was actually quite surprised that it wasn't as obnoxious as it certainly could have been. But, it was all done in good taste, and it seemed to just be, there's sort of that one, I think it's the official photo of Will and Kate, and that just seemed to be on everything. It wasn't over the top, but last night, the Globe photographer, I'm with Dina Rudick, and I went out about 2 a.m. because we're still, our time is just way off, and walking around, and we stumbled upon a souvenir stand that was just filled with Americans buying everything on the shelves. So, at 2 a.m. on the wedding day, people were still going strong, still consuming this this fairy tale, this spectacle, whatever it was, whatever it is. Lots of people like it, and lots of people consumed it.
Reporter Billy Baker covered the royal wedding for the Boston Globe.
Quote from the news, shifting tone, "I've never seen so many bodies, babies, women, so many bodies." That was Alabama resident Erica Hamilton on the toll taken by a record 138 tornadoes that ravaged southern states from Texas to Virginia, left at least 339 dead, hundreds more injured or missing, with Alabama hit hardest. President Obama paid a visit and promised speedy government help.
Next, afterbirth politics and musical chairs at the Pentagon and CIA, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern.
We do not have time for this kind of silliness. We got better stuff to do. We're not going to be able to do it if we just make stuff up and pretend that facts are not facts. We're not going to be able to solve our problems if we get distracted by sideshows and carnival barkers.
I'd want to look at it, but I hope it's true, so that we can get on to much more important matters, so the press can stop asking me questions.
More than 2 years after fringe critics first raised the question of where Barack Obama was really born, the president finally released his so-called long-form Hawaiian birth certificate and belittled the most prominent birther barker of the moment, Donald Trump. But even as the Donald typically took credit for the release, he put off conceding the document was legitimate and started questioning whether Obama's school grades really merited the young black man's matriculation at Columbia and Harvard Law.
Why did Obama decide to take the questions about his birth so seriously at last? And what will the evidence he made public last week mean for continued attacks by his critics, for Trump, and for the Republican Party, whose presidential preference polls Trump has recently topped? To consider those issues of afterbirth politics and others, including musical chairs at the Pentagon and CIA for Your Ears Only, we have TV commentator and Newsweek Daily Beast contributor Eleanor Clift. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you, David.
Was the birth issue really beginning to worry the White House?
Yes. I mean, I think it was a fringe issue until Donald Trump was taking it really mainstream on all the cable networks, and the polls were showing that 4 out of 10 Republican voters thought that President Obama was born outside of the country, and another 18% weren't sure. And so I think they realized that it was taking a toll, and it was no longer could be just dismissed as a joke.
Does the release of the certificate taint Trump and more legitimate Republican leaders who played along with the birther issue?
Well, it seems to me that it does marginalize the Republicans, but it really is what the Republican activist base wants to hear at this point. And I think if you put it in a larger context, there is a lot of anxiety about the fact that this country is going to be a majority-minority country in the not-too-near future, and an effort on the part of some people to make President Obama seem like he doesn't quite belong in the White House. And you have throughout the country these, you know, birther bills now questioning people who want to register to vote or want to run for office if they have to show more identification. It's almost like we're going back to the poll tax period.
Do you expect Trump to start slipping in the GOP polls, and if so, to whose advantage?
Yeah, I think that Trump overreached, and he's leading in the polls now mostly because of name recognition. And I think if he slips, as I expect he will, that it should give an opportunity for some of the more mainstream Republicans to get some attention. Mitt Romney, Tim Pawlenty, I think, in fact, Mr. Huntsman from Utah, I think he's another one that is going to merit a serious consideration.
What led Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour to drop out of the presidential competition that still looks so lackluster, and who benefits from that?
I think Haley Barbour is he's a savvy Paul, and I think he realized that the chances of actually winning as the governor of a deeply southern state, when he has made some comments that have raised questions about his own attitudes about race relations in this country, the fact that he was a lobbyist at a time when people don't like lobbyists, he had a lot of strikes against him, and I think he just weighed all that and didn't want to put the effort into it, knowing the kind of scrutiny that comes with being a presidential candidate.
Are you surprised that despite doubts about so many of his policies, Obama still leads in the trial heats against almost all the Republican names?
Well, I think the Republicans have not produced a credible alternative. And so I think the president has been hovering just under 50% really for most of his presidency. And considering all that he's gone through, I think those are pretty good numbers. But he certainly is vulnerable. And I think the Republicans are dissatisfied with the field that they have to choose from. And I think another person we should probably mention is Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, who is really highly regarded in both parties as someone who looks at the deficit and spending issues seriously and as governor tackles them. But he's now, moving to the right, signing a bill apparently in his state that would take funding away from Planned Parenthood. And so it looks like he may be getting into the race simply because he's moving far to the right on social issues after having called for a truce on social issues, which the party base didn't like.
Do you think the turn on the birther issue undermines GOP leverage in the serious battles that Obama was talking about over federal deficits and the debt ceiling?
You know, I think it is a sideshow, and the people who were trying to put together a deal, the gang of six in the Senate, the task force headed by Vice President Biden, the people who headed the deficit commission, I think they're all busy working. I really don't. What the birther issue does, though, is it elevates fringe voices in the party, and it emboldens some of those fringe voices to really just want to blow up the whole political system. And with the need to raise the debt limit coming up, you hear more Republicans and some Democrats, too, saying they might not go along with it. They want to send a message to, I don't know exactly who, but to the political system.
Let's look at the national security shakeup. Is CIA Director Leon Panetta, a former California congressman, going to the Pentagon more for its war against budget cuts than any foreign challenges?
I think Leon Panetta started political life as a Republican House member who was always known as a budget cutter, and of course he was then the head of the budget office under Clinton. He's also a very savvy operator in the ways of Washington, and so I think if you accept the notion that defense spending is going to have to come down if we're going to get spending under control, I mean, he's a very good person to install at the Pentagon. And in fact, the outgoing defense secretary, Mr. Gates, actually is the one who recommended that Leon Panetta succeed him. So he's got a lot of respect on both sides of the political aisle in the military establishment.
Some say that putting David Petraeus, the country's best-known general, at CIA undermines the agency's independence as military and intelligence operations increasingly overlap, even if Petraeus leaves the Army. What's your view?
I don't know that right now President Obama is seeking independence for the CIA. I think he likes the kind of war that combines the intelligence assets with limited military assets. In other words, drones without pilots and special forces on the ground. So you're not risking too many American lives. So I think the purists are going to say that Petraeus undermines the division between the military and civilian life. But if you look back over the history of the CIA, there have been plenty of military people who have headed it. So I don't expect that's going to derail his confirmation. I mean, he's the top general of our generation, and he can almost have whatever he wants. And I think the president put him there in part because he doesn't want him to have the presidency. It takes him out of the running as a potential presidential rival.
TV commentator Eleanor Clift is a Newsweek Daily Beast contributor. Her books include 2 Weeks of Life, a memoir of love, death, and politics, Founding Sisters and the 19th Amendment, and Madam President, Shattering the Last Glass Ceiling.
Quote from the news, for many Catholics, he's already a saint, even without beatification, and let's be honest, even without a miracle. That was Andrea Riccardi, leader of a liberal Catholic group, before the beatification of Pope John Paul II. The procedure was fast-tracked despite complaints from some critics that the church sex abuse and cover-up scandal during John Paul's papacy should preclude him from sainthood.
Next, an update on Mideast uprisings for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. Everyone else can talk about it. I can't. That was Northwestern law professor Joseph Margulies representing Guantanamo inmate Abu Zubaydah on the irony that he's prevented by law from viewing or discussing classified documents made public by WikiLeaks that show how little solid evidence there is about such detainees and how some still being held are considered no more dangerous than others who've been released. Now this.
There's no magic bullet, so to speak, that's going to convince Gaddafi to stop this. It's going to be a combination of what we're doing now, what we do in the future with, in terms of the other political tools, the non-military tools that we might bring to bear.
My government calls on President Assad to change course now and heed the calls of his own people.
These attempts have failed because they lacked fairness, objectivity.
Stalemate was the watchword in Libya last week as U.S. Ambassador Jean Kretz conceded at a State Department news conference. That was followed by another proposal for peace talks by Muammar Gaddafi and its quick rejection by NATO until Gaddafi forces cease attacks on rebel strongholds. And on Syria's continued crushing of pro-democracy demonstrations, Washington also seemed stymied. Despite demands at the United Nations by U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice, her Syrian counterpart noted not even enough support for an official Security Council condemnation.
Meanwhile, the post-protest military regime in Egypt moved to normalize relations with Iran and brokered an alliance between rival Palestinian factions, adding new hurdles to any peace with Israel and possibly to vital international support for Palestine itself. To update the region's uprisings, for your ears only, we're joined again by Jean-Pierre Filliou, visiting professor of Middle East Studies at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. His books include Apocalypse in Islam and, this summer, The Arab Revolution, 10 Lessons from the Democratic Uprising. Welcome back to our program. First on Libya, do you think NATO and the U.S. can take greater military action against Gaddafi without risking condemnation by the regional leaders who first asked them to step in and protect Libyan civilians?
Well, it's not only the issue of regional leaders. It's basically the issue of Libyan sovereignty. Nobody wants any foreign soldier on the ground. That's really the red line that nobody should cross, even if insurgents at times ask for more focused action against Gaddafi.
The allies say their bombing and drone missile strikes are not aimed at Gaddafi, but what do you see happening to the rebellion and the resistance if he does happen to be killed?
Of course, that's the key. And every day they're openly praying for it, because this is a one-man regime and it will probably collapse if this one man, one way or another, disappears.
What non-military political tools do you think would be necessary to remove Gaddafi, or must he remain part of any settlement if he refuses to go?
No, the freezing of the asset is still partial. We are talking about $30 billion, which means a lot, but it's only one little part of the immense riches that Gaddafi had plundered over the past 40 years, and it's still critical for him to pay his mercenaries and weapons.
You assess the Libyan rebels as largely reflecting the nationalist spirit of Facebook freedom fighters around the region, but even some of their supporters in the U.S. fear giving them more powerful weapons that could end up being used against us. What's your view on that?
Well, there is a consensus among the resistance and the Libyan insurgency. It's being pro-U.S. and very favorable and grateful to NATO. So the idea that those people who are now fighting for their freedom would become enemies in the near future seems to me not very well grounded.
And you're not worried about infiltration in their ranks by more sinister forces?
Well, at this moment, and I've been following that very closely, the Islamists that are fighting among their ranks, especially in the Syrian Annika, are basically nationalists. You know, they are not jihadis. There are no jihadis around, and they've taken great pain to avoid any cooperation with them.
Turning to Syria, it's clear Washington isn't willing to go even as far in defense of democracy as did in Libya because Syria is so much more critical to the region. Does that make us look hypocritical or realistic? And why is Syria so important?
Well, the situation is very different in Syria. In Libya, you had this insurgency that was controlling more than half of the country and that was exposed to possible bloodshed if Benghazi would have fallen the very day NATO intervened. Now in Syria, you have popular protests all over the country, and certainly you have Deraa as a base next to the border with Jordan, but not the same context that would require foreign interference in a military way.
In Egypt, from the moment President Mubarak was forced out, analysts said more attention would be paid to popular sentiment against Israel and for the Palestinians. And brokering reconciliation between the Hamas and Fatah factions clearly seems to bear that out. How do you see it affecting the chances for an Israeli-Palestinian peace?
Well, first, one has to see how this agreement will be fulfilled, because the two factions have still a lot of issues to debate. But in the principle, Hamas is supposed, and I insist on, is supposed to endorse any agreement that Fatah would reach. So that could be a way also to engage this faction into some kind of peace process. Let's hope so.
And how does the Hamas-Fatah deal affect a promised plea for United Nations recognition of a Palestinian state?
Well, again, it remains to be seen what is exactly the extent of the implementation of this agreement. But it's true that if there is one loser on the Palestinian scene from this agreement, it's Prime Minister Fayyad, who is the very man pushing for this recognition.
What impact do you see from Cairo warming its relations with Iran?
Well, it's not warming relations, it's establishing diplomatic relations. The fact that there was no diplomatic relation between those two major countries in the region was an anomaly. I don't see any love lost or gained between the two countries so far.
In general, do you see the uprising in Egypt moving it toward real democracy?
Well, already 1 month ago, we had a referendum with more than 60% turnout, which is 5 or 10 times more than any elections during the Mubarak regime. So already there is popular participation, and the referendum has been endorsed, and apparently the new elections are going to happen very soon. So this is a significant measure of new democracy, certainly.
Jean-Pierre Filliou is a visiting professor of Middle East Studies at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. His books include Apocalypse in Islam and, this summer, The Arab Revolution, 10 Lessons from the Democratic Uprising.
Quote from the news, "They raped me with their hands." That was CBS chief foreign correspondent Lara Logan on the sexual assault she suffered in Cairo's Tahrir Square during pro-democracy protests. Logan says she's not going back to the Middle East for the time being, but has become more sensitive to the harsh treatment of women in the region.
Next, the real prospects for change in Cuba, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "We haven't been tracking anybody. Never have. Never will." That was Apple boss Steve Jobs reemerging from medical leave after millions of queries and promised congressional hearings about a file in iPhones and iPads that stores information on wireless hotspot and cell tower connections. Sony, meanwhile, admitted a delay in telling PlayStation users about a massive leak of their personal ID information. Now this.
Que resulta recomendable limitar a un máximo de 2 periodos consecutivos de 5 años.
The endorsement by Cuban President Raúl Castro of 10-year term limits for political leaders, including himself, was one of hundreds of reforms that drew dutiful applause last month at the island's first Communist Party Congress in 14 years. Of course, given the advanced age of many in the leadership, known as historicos, it's not clear how many could go on much longer than that, in any event. Still, the biggest change of the Congress was a lineup of leaders that, for the first time ever, did not include Castro's elder brother Fidel, icon of the revolution, apparently because of continuing ill health.
But how much the changes in Cuba's leadership and stated policies will really mean for its people, for their relatives in the United States, and for key economic and diplomatic relations with Washington remains very much an open question. With some perspective for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, COHA. Welcome back to our program.
Hello, David.
Beyond the 2 5-year term limits on political leaders, what were some of the other top reforms put before the Cuban Communist Party Congress?
I think that this was a very important meeting because we all get tired of this kind of non-speak rhetoric that they use at such occasions. But if someone is a serious student of these issues, you're going to look and see real results. For example, for the first time, you're going to be able to buy and sell a house. But you can't do it right now. You only can inherit a house. You can't sell it. Also, there have been hundreds of new service sectors that have been opened up. And they are going to take off the state sector, the state labor sector, up to 1.5 million workers. That is a huge development.
We know there's already been some permission of private enterprise on the island, but a recent COHA analysis says that permission is actually another route to greater government control, permitting taxation of what's now a busy black market. What kind of economic activity goes on underground in Cuba?
Well, the black market is firmly entrenched in Cuba. although on a recent trip that I took there, I noticed that people took no chances with being caught engaging in it. And no one is saying that the Cuban economy is in spry shape. We don't have a robust economy. The problem is that the leadership is viewing this with genuine alarm. And Raul Castro speaks about the bloated bureaucracy and the need to modernize society. He said that you shouldn't require Communist Party membership in order to get a job to work in the government. Now, all of these things you can almost view as breathlessly novel, taken together with the fact that a number of months ago, the Cubans released a number of political prisoners, pretty much liquidating their inventory of political prisoners, we are seeing a society that's ripe to be negotiated with by Washington. But unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, what would Washington require to get to the point of acknowledging this? I mean, what would they want to see in terms of enactment of these policies?
Well, the basic problem here, David, is that we're talking not about a foreign policy, but a domestic policy. U.S. policy towards Cuba is aimed at Dade County. The Florida strategy of the Republicans as they go into elections. So it almost doesn't matter what Cuba does. They're not going to get negotiations out of Washington because Washington feels the political costs of such negotiations aren't worth the pain. But here, I think, is a mortal flaw because the pain is a distorted U.S. policy towards Latin America that is, quite frankly, this administration, the Obama administration, has an abysmal Latin American policy, a shameful one. Whether you look at Honduras supporting the coup there, or you're looking at countries that are given A ratings in order to get them set up for free trade agreements, we don't have a earnest and sincere policy aimed at introducing new ideas and new thoughts. Cuba right now is very vulnerable. It would be a great time for the United States to initiate negotiations. Raul Castro has said, I will meet the Americans any place, any time. Well, you know, the Americans will meet with North Korea and Iran and any other country, but Cuba is exempted from this strategy because of domestic political considerations.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Cuban political conditions. Raul Castro is 79. The new vice president is 80. A disappointment to those hoping for a new change generation at the helm. Are there any obvious younger leaders in waiting with potentially new priorities or approaches?
Well, it's almost the kiss of death if one is boosting someone. If you mention his name, he's finished. what do we have here? The fact is that Castro himself speaks about the fact that the Cuba does not have a backup team of administrators. We don't have trained people, he says, and we need them. There's a tug of war. I mean, this we're talking about a 50-year-old revolution, one in which Fidel Castro has been venerated or condemned, but one that's gone on, that has deep roots, but one that is acknowledging its shortcomings. Cuba today is not a prime human rights violator. Its negatives are relatively on the short end. It's not a particular. It's certainly an authoritarian regime, but it's an authoritarian regime that's ready to talk. And the Obama administration, I feel, is sort of showing a kind of unattractive political hand here in not having the courage to negotiate.
Larry Burns is director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington.
Next, Don't Tread on Me, the killer tire movie, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. CBS News, like Katie herself, is looking forward to the next chapter. That was the network's response to the evening news anchor telling People magazine she's leaving to engage in, quote, more multidimensional storytelling. Now this.
This is what our killer looks like.
A tire.
Exactly. I give you an hour to find him. Can't have gotten far. If you have any questions, it's now or never.
Is it black?
Yes, it is. And round. Decidedly demonic. And the star of an unlikely new horror comedy or comedy horror film called Rubber, directed by Quentin Dupieux, also known as the French techno music producer Mr. Uizo. Set in a sun-bleached desert landscape, it tells how the tire named Robert comes to life and kills people with psychic powers. The concept, albeit unusual, isn't all that far from past hits featuring killer cars, deadly dolls, and terrorist tomatoes, the kind you find in ketchup.
Still, some critics see Rubber on a different level, mixing mayhem with meta, sly wit, and irreverence. It even received an official selection honor at the 2010 Cannes Film Festival and a distribution deal from Magnet Releasing Magnolia Pictures. To talk about his view of the film's traction, along with other recent releases for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
So will Rubber mean, as Eddie put it in his script, a good year for the director? Is it a successful spoof, a sly shock, or just schlock?
I will tell you, this is a great idea for a short film, and even a long short film, that doesn't quite, you should pardon the pun, stretch it out for a feature length, but I am glad I saw it. And again, you know, like I say in the review, it's certainly an original idea. It is no retread. But you can tell, you know, boy, is this directed by a French director. It is meta deconstruction of a horror movie like you haven't seen. First of all, you've got a tire as the killer. I mean, which, you know, in a weird way makes sense. We've had cars. We've had, you know, other inanimate objects. Why not just take it down to ground zero and just, like, you know, scrub it down to basics and have a tire, a rubber tire. Just go around and it has the ability to explode people's heads, which, you know, why not? And every now and then the movie cuts away to a bunch of people standing on a cliff with binoculars watching the movie we're watching, and after a while we realize they're like the audience. They're the paying customers. There's a couple of fanboys. There's a couple of teenage girls telling them to shut up and stop talking during the movie. They're us. They're the audience. It's that kind of movie where the director's playing games with, you know, why we watch horror movies, how we respond to them, and what we want out of them.
Rubber has no big-name movie stars, yet still gets major distribution and buzz, which should be good news for what otherwise might be seen as risky small-budget projects. What are the factors at play here, though? Changing taste, the lower cost, and better quality of indie films today, or free word of mouth magnified by social networks and the internet?
I'll tell you what I think is going on here. First of all, you know, there's a growing midnight movie crowd. I think the midnight movie experience is starting to come back thanks to the internet. There's a sort of groundswell and a desire to see low-budget, interesting, creative, funny, scary, what have you, kinds of movies. But also I think the internet and developments like YouTube and websites like funnyordie.com are making these kind of outrageous ideas palatable and really putting them across, priming audiences to see an unusual idea like this and sort of get into it at the ironic meta level that it's intended at. You need a very sort of sophisticated way of looking at movies to get into this, and you get that in a lot of entertainment that's online right now.
Let's consider some other recent releases. First, another soapbox for Robert Redford, the conspirator about a woman linked to Lincoln's assassination. What's the message? How's the movie?
Well, the message of the movie is muck around with the Constitution at your peril. Do not put U.S. citizens on trial, on military trials, without juries of their peers. And, gee, if you think that it has relevance to today and the, you know, issues of Guantanamo Bay and rendition, well, sure, you know, Robert Redford wants you to make those parallels. The story in question is of a woman who was accused of being part of a conspiracy to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. And she's played by Robin Wright. And I have to tell you, it's a worthy message. It's a pretty stultifying film. I feel like Robert Redford has kind of lost the knack of compelling movie making that he showed earlier in his career with, you know, movies like Ordinary People or River Runs Through It. This is classic illustrated animatronic filmmaking that kind of does a disservice to the story.
What about Hannah, starring that young Irish actress? How do you pronounce her name?
Sorsay.
Yeah, she was great in Atonement.
She's terrific in Atonement, and you have the same director, Joe Wright, who discovered her for Atonement, directing this much less ambitious, less artistic, more galvanizing action movie about, you know, a 12-year-old girl who's been trained as, you know, the ultimate killer and unleashed by her father on the evil CIA agent who may have had a hand in creating her, which is played by Kate Blanchett, with dripping with a southern accent and just having great fun doing a villainous turn.
Henry's Crime stars Keanu Reeves. What's the storyline there?
Well, you know, where has Keanu Reeves been lately? I mean, you know, he saved the universe a bunch of movies back, but it's been a while. And this is a very small, whimsical movie about a kind of guy who's kind of just out to lunch, the way Keanu Reeves can sometimes seem in movies, so much so that he accidentally drives a getaway car in a bank robbery and ends up doing, you know, 3 years in jail, and then kind of figures that, you know, if he did the time, he might as well do the crime. So he gets out and he thinks, maybe I will rob that bank, and he gets his ex cellmate, played by James Caan, involved, and Vera Farmiga shows up as an actress in a Chekhov play that somehow is involved with a bank robbery. It's one of these small films that almost packs too much plot and whimsical character in it, and either it works for you or it doesn't. It worked for me, because I got a fondness for Keanu Reeves. I think he's like the black Labrador Retriever of movie stars.
Ty Burr is an author and film critic for the Boston Globe, and this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. Special friends. That was the source of cell keys cited by some of the 500 Taliban members who escaped from Afghanistan's Sarposa prison through a lengthy and sophisticated underground tunnel to a nearby home. Official complicity and corruption were obvious.
For Your Ears Only is online anytime at iTunes, News and Politics, or podcastbunker.com. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donations or foundation grants. Please email david.ears.only@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan and Paul Roesk at Argo Studios with interns Kate McGee and Karina Capabianca. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern. For Your Ears Only is a production of GateWave Incorporated, a 24/7 nonprofit radio reading service bringing vital information and enrichment to those who can't see.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on the show a year ago. I'm Karina Capabianca. This week last year, we noted how often harsh reality confounds policy and politics. From our May 2, 2010 Newsweek On Air broadcast, hosted by David and Melissa Exelberth.
The magnitude, the volume of the spill, the amount of potential area that can be impacted, the environmental and economic impact and damage that will be created by that. Having dealt with these for a long time, I'm frightened.
This is harassment against our community. This is harassment in the country. And I want to tell you how I really see this law. I see it like a malignant tumor.
The majority leader has indicated we'll have an open amendment process and plenty of opportunities to treat this like the serious, comprehensive bill that it is. We have many amendments that we intend to offer.
Reality has a way of frustrating both policies and politics. The same calamitous offshore oil well leak that frightened David Kennedy of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration swiftly quieted Republican cries of drill, baby, drill. But it also complicated President Obama's plan to make future offshore drilling a cornerstone of bipartisan climate and energy legislation. Similarly, outrage like that expressed by Lillian Rodriguez-Lopez of the Hispanic Federation over Arizona's immigration crackdown had even some conservative Republicans expressing doubt, and the Capitol Hill grilling of Goldman Sachs on alleged investment improprieties helped prompt Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to stop blocking debate on a bill to re-regulate Wall Street.
To consider these and other developments of the week, we're joined again by political consultant Craig Shirley, author of Rendezvous with Destiny, Ronald Reagan and the Campaign That Changed America. Welcome back to Newsweek on Air.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the spill. Does it pretty much end the drill, baby, drill Republican chorus that led Obama to include new offshore development in his climate energy plan?
Well, you know, like it or not, this is still an oil-based economy. It has been for 100 years and probably will be for the foreseeable future. Although, you know, the spill is obviously a terrible thing, and everybody hopes it's cleaned up and capped quickly, is that there's still an overwhelming demand in this country for refined oil in the form of gasoline. And so drilling will have to continue if the country's going to meet its energy needs. And there are obviously political ramifications to this as well, because we're coming into the summer driving season, and prices tend to spike in the summer. But if there's a moratorium on drilling, that's going to add to speculation that oil prices are going to go up. And, of course, speculation always leads, in fact, to oil prices going up. So, and that won't make the American consumer very happy. So there's very strong political ramifications for President Obama in any moratorium on drilling.
I think it's a moratorium on new drilling. He's not talking about ending stuff that's going on now.
Right.
I'm wondering, many say that climate energy legislation can't pass without that offshore component, but can Republicans continue to hold it hostage with that demand after this Louisiana catastrophe?
Yeah, because I think, David, I think that the consumer demand is going to overwhelm the concerns about the environment, because at the end of the day, is that drilling has proven over many, many years to be, you know, offshore drilling to be a very safe form of recovering trapped oil. The last significant spill that we had was in Santa Barbara, and that was almost 40 years ago. So, you know, and again, while these things are terrible, you have to look at these things in terms of the impact on the economy and the American consumer. And, you know, you would never want this to happen at any time whatsoever, but if it's only once every 40 years, the American people probably can tolerate it.
Switching to immigration, at least some degree of doubt or criticism about Arizona's Papers, Please law have been expressed by GOP Congressman Connie Mack in Florida, former Governor Jeb Bush there, current governor and former Republican Charlie Crist, and his GOP opponent for Senate, Marco Rubio. How big a factor is Republican realization that a huge Hispanic vote nationwide may be at stake?
There's no doubt that there are going to be political ramifications to this. The question is, which way are they going to go? Most of the polling data right now shows it to be popular with the American people, despite the pounding the Arizona bill has taken from the East Coast media and political establishment over the last 4 or 5 days. And it's popular in Arizona, as evidenced by the Jan Brewer's polling. Before she signed the bill, her approval rating was in the 40s. Now it shot up to in the 70s. The problem is that both sides, there's anger on both sides, and they're not approaching this thing rationally. The fact of the matter is, I've looked at this law, is that it pretty much restates federal law that simply wasn't enforced. My concern as a civil libertarian is how it can be potentially abused by local police forces in Arizona. I think, and that's where the discussion should be, is making sure that there's proper restraint on law enforcement officials in Arizona.
Finally, on the financial reform front, Republicans claim to win by prompting elimination of a $50 billion fund from big banks to help dismember failed ones. But did they really find they were looking too much like defenders of Wall Street by not even permitting debate on tighter regulation?
Yes, they flubbed this badly, David. The Republicans had the winning side on the argument, and this is what's so tragic and so comic also about the National Republican Party, is that despite the thumping in 2006, despite the thumping in 2008, despite all the evidence before them that this country does not want two big government parties, they still pursue a big government agenda. What they should have done has come up with their own proposal that would have drained power and money out of Wall Street and put it back into community banks and put it back into the local and county and state banks, where money would be more readily available for investment, for lending, for housing, for development, all those things, and much less chance of corruption, because you'd have much tighter oversight at the local level by the communities and by the state regulators, as opposed to concentrating all this power in money in Washington. So they backed themselves into a corner, and now President Obama and the Democrats have won the day on the politics of Wall Street reform.
Even without a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate now, do you expect the Democrats to pass some sort of financial overhaul?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about it, that they will pass something because they have the political advantage. They have the clear political advantage, and they'll get it, my guess is, fairly quickly. What concessions they'll make to the Republicans, I don't know. Maybe the $50 billion pool of money to bail out future bad guys on Wall Street. They might get some concessions on that. They might get some concessions to community banks. But at the end of the day, I think it's a lead pipe cinch that a bill is going to pass with significant Republican support in the Senate.
Craig Shirley is veteran GOP media and political consultant. His new book is Rendezvous with Destiny, Ronald Reagan and the Campaign That Changed America.
Policy versus Reality, from our May 2nd, 2010 Newsweek On Air broadcast. The administration had to give up on a strong energy and environment bill, and it lifted a deepwater drilling ban in the Gulf last October 12th, although the first actual approval of a drilling permit since the BP disaster was not reported until March 1st. The Justice Department filed suit against Arizona's Papers, Please immigration law, and a federal appeals court last month upheld an injunction against its most controversial elements. But similar laws are in the works in Florida, Alabama, South Carolina, and Georgia. A financial reform bill did pass, but detailed rules are still being written, with Wall Street lobbyists pressing legislators for less stringent regulation in many areas. I'm Karina Capobianca. We'll visit the archive again next week.